You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by the MLB.com Shop.
This is MLB.com Extras, American League Central Edition. I'm Anthony Cashman, and today I'll be joined by Jason Beck, Jordan Bastian, Scott Merkin, Steve Stewart of the Royals Radio Network, and Chris Atterbury of the Twins Radio Network. We're going to talk about each Central team as we're here in mid-January and about a month away from camp's opening, and see what teams have done to position themselves to be in the best position to win what's going to be a really tough division. So we'll hope you'll tune in and check it out. Joined by Jason Beck. And, boy, what do you think is the number one topic with the Tigers these days? Could it still be Max Scherzer? Of course. Is this guy going to go into spring training unsigned? Of course not. Somebody's going to sign Max Scherzer. Everybody seems to think the Tigers are still the favorite, despite some kind of public distance they've taken from this particular market. But Beck and I have talked in last week's podcast about how Scherzer still makes sense in a lot of ways for the Tigers. But, Beck, I don't suppose you have any late-breaking news for us or any major developments in the Max Scherzer situation, do you?
No. It's, you know, it's unless he's gone off to the Far East or you're going to pitch in Venezuela in winter ball or something. I think he's going to Korea. Why not? You know, it's, you know, it makes as good sense as anything right now. It's we're in that holding pattern, and you get that sense. And I've heard things are starting to move, but it still doesn't sound like any deal with anybody's imminent. But you just kind of get that sense that you know, Boris is waiting for one of these teams that says they're not in quote-unquote active pursuit to get into active pursuit.
Right.
And then things would start moving. But I think right now you have a bunch of teams, or at least some amount of teams, sitting around waiting for somebody to create some momentum here. And then you can kind of get this thing closer to a resolution.
Yeah, I mean, I think we agree the $200 million possibility, it seems to be off the table. I mean, this is a time of year when teams, by and large, have their budgets kind of locked in, or their budget parameters locked in, at least. And, you know, to be seeking something of that nature this late in the game seems unlikely. And we always wait for that, you know, mystery team, especially in the Boris markets, that mystery team to emerge. I wrote something last week for Sports on Earth about how the Astros, as a mystery team, make a lot of sense as far as where they're at budget-wise, and it wouldn't hurt them as much to give up the draft pick because they have two of the first five picks, and they're both protected. You know, maybe that's a possibility. Everybody keeps pointing to the Red Sox, the team that could really use a top of the rotation arm to go with what they've already done this winter, and of course we talked about the Tigers as well. And but there's just no great fit when you're talking about you know, kind of a record-setting, record-breaking free agent pitching contract. I think that's just not going to happen.
Right. Yeah, I keep hearing that, you know, he wants more than 6 years, which makes sense. I mean, he might be asking for eight for all I know. I think a seven-year deal might be that sweet spot. You know, somebody's probably almost surely going to have to go seven to get it done. You know, I don't think that offer that was out there in spring training is going to get it done. Yeah. I mean, that's just the sense I get. At least at this point. I mean, we'll see, you know, if we're here in a month talking about where's Max Scherzer going to go, maybe it's different. But I'd be surprised if we're there. Average value, I can't see Scherzer, you know, breaking some sort of plateau on average value at this point, unless, again, you know, unless there's something unforeseen happens where, you know, a pitcher goes down on a contending team, and, you know, their postseason hopes loom on, you know, being able to fill that spot with somebody who's of the same caliber. You know, kind of basically like a Victor Martinez type scenario where you have a team in a desperate need. You know, I think we've made the case where, you know, for plenty of teams that have a need for him, varying degrees of need, you know, Tigers among them. I don't know if we've made that case of a team in a desperate need, you know, a desperate, urgent need to get something done right now quite yet.
Yeah, and guys are kind of ramping up their pitching program, so who knows what could happen in the major league landscape. But for the meantime, though, Beck, I still say put the Max Scherzer curveball in the KBO and watch those hitters flail. All right, more pertinent to the Tigers, perhaps, just given that this is a guy they know is on their club for 2015, is Miguel Cabrera, of course, coming off of the ankle injury last year and the ankle surgery, which when it was performed after the Tigers were eliminated from the postseason, the word back from the Tigers is that the injury was worse than they even thought, and what he was playing through was more difficult than they even imagined. So he's still recovering. He's in a walking boot. It sounds like, Becky, he won't be ready at the start of spring training, which I don't think is a big surprise. What is Miggy's overall timetable looking like?
Beyond that, we're not really sure. It sounds like they're still hopeful for opening day. I think they don't really want to get too into that until they see, you know, how he reacts once he gets out of the walking boot and starts doing baseball related activity. You know, that's really going to be the key thing, especially with somebody, you know, with that type of body frame. You got to see how, you know, the leg supports that body. He's going to be playing catch up in spring training. That much, you know, I think we all expected that. You know, now's just the point where they admitted it. You know, it was interesting that the appointment, you know, we were originally expecting a follow-up exam on Cabrera, you know, right around this time, right around mid-January. The fact that it's a little bit later is interesting. You know, they say he's doing a little bit more than expected as far as what he can do while wearing the walking boot. So in that sense, it's, you know, it's probably good news. But then again, the fact that, you know, you're not going to have him cleared to do full activity until a week before spring training, you know, that leaves a lot of ground to make up. And I know, I mean, you've been in enough spring trainings, you know. I mean, a lot of these guys only need like a certain number of at-bats.
Right.
And they're ready. I mean, most of the length of spring training is for pitchers, not hitters. But you've got to be able to have enough time to get him moving on the leg, to get him moving at first base. And also, I think really importantly, is to get him to test out on the base paths and kind of, you know, get used to the acceleration again and be able to build up that strength where he can push off a little bit. Those reactions are going to be crucial for him, you know, on the bases and in the field. So, you know, I think it's a lot more than just getting that timing at the plate and everything's fine. You know, he's got to be able to build up this, you know, the ankle and the foot to be able to support that and be able to get some explosive movement, because, you know, as much as he hits, his game is still, you know, it relies on explosion in the lower body. So I think once we see, you know, assuming he gets cleared in mid-February, you know, once that happens and once we see him moving around, I think they'll have a better idea pretty quickly just to how realistic opening day is.
Well, you know, obviously Miggy's injury issues really sunk the Tigers at the end of 2013. Last year, he plays through it, and his September numbers were terrific, especially when you know the full scope of what he was dealing with. And it was the bullpen that ultimately betrayed the Tigers. I mean, hurt them all year, and obviously made a big difference on that division series against the Orioles. And it's gone, you know, relatively untouched. Now, they did add Tom Gorzolani. We talked about that in last week's podcast. You know, Bruce Rondon, they're certainly hoping for a healthy return and effective return for him. But, Beck, I mean, where the bullpen's at, largely, it's a lot of, you know, crossing your fingers and hope guys bounce back, basically. That seems to be the plan. Do you think there's any room in the budget? And obviously, the Scherzer situation plays into anything a lot of the Tigers right now. And if they do sign Scherzer, we've mentioned this, Alfredo Simon could transition the bullpen. Now you're helping both ends, but if they don't sign Scherzer, there's still a number of guys still out there, Rafael Soriano, K-Rod, Casey Jansen. There's guys like Alexi Ogando. We saw what he did against the Tigers in the 2011 ALCS in a relief role. But is that still a market you expect them to delve into, or what are your expectations there?
Yeah, I think they're still open to looking from the sense, you know, talking with Dave Dombrowski, but it sounds like, you know, if they're going to do much, it's probably going to be on minor league deals and camp invites. They did not have a scout at Ogando's showcase session last week, which was kind of surprising. I think what he's looking for in terms of a deal doesn't sound like, you know, what the Tigers think they can fit in to what they want to do. Their 40-man roster is actually, you know, pretty tight right now.
Yeah.
But even, you know, beyond that, just I think right now they're willing to play the waiting game with some of these guys. And, you know, once they got Gorzolani on the major league deal, I think that was – they've been looking for other guys, you know, just to be willing to take non-roster invites right now and be willing to try to compete for a job and then figure it out later. Are there guys out there who will be willing to accept it? Yeah, I mean, probably. It's probably going to take until later in the off season, but close to spring training, probably. But you know, it's surprising, I guess, that they're so close to say they are. But I had a good talk with Brad Ausmus a couple of days ago, actually, about this and about how, yeah, I mean, they are willing to bank on guys rebounding. You know, it's funny because this is an organization that for years has gone on the idea that it's hard to invest long-term deals in non-closing relievers because, you know, that end of the bullpen in their view is so changeable from one year to the next that what you get from a guy in one year is no guarantee of what you'll get from him, you know, the following season. And so they've really done when they've gone onto the open market for those guys, it's really been a matter of trying to find the right guy at the right time and then time it right. And in a lot of cases, they don't feel like they timed it right last year. They got the bad season from Joe Nathan, although Ausmus was saying what they saw in the second half gives them some hope that he can turn it around. They obviously expect a better Joaquin Soria than what they saw down the stretch, especially given the numbers he put up in Texas. They think they caught Gorzolani in the right time frame, a couple years separated from surgery. They expect better from some other guys along the road. They think Al Albuquerque can play a bigger role. And they think some of the guys in the system that they can get something from these guys. You know, Rondon's obvious. You know, they think that he should be ready, although, you know, talking with Brad, it sounds like you're going to play cautious with him, certainly early on, and maybe for the first half of the year, just trying not to overuse him and kind of put that arm at risk so soon after Tommy John. Mm. But even beyond that, I think Kyle Ryan's still a guy that is worth watching, you know, a guy who made some starts for them down the stretch, but the way he responded in a couple of bullpen situations last year, you know, some of them key situations, gives him, you know, some belief that this is a guy who might respond well to a relief role, you know, maybe almost in like a Smiley type of situation.
No concern from Ausmus about the fact that Ausmus himself raked against Gorzolani in his career?
He got a kick out of that, actually. He didn't remember, you know, hitting Gorzolani so hard in his major league debut. He remembered talking with him not long after that. And I guess Gorzolani did, too, because he said, you know, he never forgot how nice Ausmus was to him early in his career when he was a nobody. So, yeah, I guess, you know, there was some sort of lasting impact for that. But you know, Ausmus was saying that, that was right around the time where he had learned to go the opposite field with left-handed pitchers, and it really changed his numbers. So, you know, he remembered that part of it, but he didn't remember the specific game. So, you know, take that for what it's worth.
Wow, and obviously he's open to opposing hitters aren't watching video of Brad Ausmus and picking up on some things when they face Gorzolani this coming year. But We'll see what the future holds for the Tigers bullpen and what the future holds for Max Scherzer, who's kind of the key to the whole thing right now in the hot stove talk in January. So I want to thank Jason Beck for joining us to talk about that and everything else Tigers related. And once again, joined by Steve Stewart, Royals broadcaster. And Steve, we talked a little bit last week, just kind of the overall outlook for these Royals and some of the moves they've made. Kendry Morales, Alex Rios, Edison Volquez. They made another move this week that doesn't impact things on the field itself, but Ned Yost gets an extension through 2016, and we certainly know that you know, managers and players too, for that matter, like to know there's some stability in the dugout. They like to know what the long-term situation is. This is an extremely long-term situation. The extension is just 1 year through 2016, but it certainly illustrates how different Yost's situation is from even a year ago, when he was one of those guys, you know, people were labeling as a hot seat kind of manager, and that continued on into the season. He's certainly a guy who's endured a lot of criticism in his career, but certainly got the last laugh in many respects with the Royals reaching the World Series last year. So your thoughts on this extension?
Yeah, the situation you're describing, you could describe a lot of managers and coaches that way, where, you know, because I think you can always overrate the importance of a head coach or manager to some degree, because obviously you're really at the mercy of what your players do. And I mean, you know, you can ask any manager that, any head coach that, you know, it's like I'm, you can only do so much when you're the manager. Having said that, as you know, Anthony, I mean, a lot of what you do is set a tone, cliche as that sounds, create an environment, and you know, well, first of all, Ned's in an enviable position for anybody listening, because everybody would love to be in the position where, well, if suddenly tomorrow you lost your job, you know, A, you'd get paid really, really well for the next 12 months, and now 24 months, and B, you know, you're probably in a position where, you know, you don't have to work if you don't want the rest of your life. So you're kind of personally, you're in a no-lose in that regard. And so, you know, he's kind of been in the catbird seat. And then the other angle you throw in there, now they didn't win the World Series, but they got to the World Series. And they, you know, he accomplished something monumental, getting the Royals back to the postseason and making the run that they did. So, you know, he's in a really nice situation. His contract that he had signed a couple of years ago until today had only gone through this upcoming season. And so, you know, he and Dayton Moore and the Glass family, the ownership group, have a very good understanding, good working relationship. It was never, I sensed zero tension over this or anything like that. And that, you know, basically it got to be September and the Royals were fighting for their first playoff spot in almost 30 years. And it's, you know, people talk a little bit to the manager about his situation or Dayton about situation. And then the thought was, hey, you know, we're trying to win here. We'll worry about that after the season. And so, this is not a surprise at all. I think it's good news for the team, for the players who are there, where there's still a young core that's going to be there beyond 2015. And there's a comfort level. You know, Ned's gotten criticized for a lot of reasons, whether it's, you know, being a little too National League for the American League with bunting, although a lot of that I think is his own players choosing to. He has some guys that just like to bunt. And, you know, and sometimes with, you know, answers to media and things and being short with answers at times. And the biggest one, and he got this in Milwaukee, and he's gotten it at times in Kansas City, is being, quote-unquote, you know, too protective, too supportive of his players. But I think he's been vindicated in both Milwaukee and Kansas City in being so protective, so positive on those guys. I mean, I talked to Tom Haudricourt, who has covered the Brewers forever, and you know, they have kind of a famous press conference there in which Jeff Supon, who's now with the Royals, by the way, in a coaching capacity, but Supon wasn't the same pitcher he had been, and Ned would come out after the game and say, "Soup was great today. Soup was great today." You know, and he was just so positive, and you know, he's sort of denying reality to everybody else watching, but you know, when he speaks, you know, he's speaking through the media to his clubhouse.
Right.
Because he knows every one of those guys is a human being and has insecurities and wonders about his status. And and you don't have a manager holding your hands when you're in the major leagues, but they see a quote and they see positive, and they might feel really bad about the way they just performed, but they see their manager publicly standing up for them, and he goes to the mat for these guys, and that's how, and especially with a young team, which Milwaukee was and the Royals have been, that's especially important. You know, he ran all those young Brewers out there every day, Ricky Weeks, on and on and on. And then when he got to the Royals, guys like Alcides Escobar, when they struggled to hit, he kept running them out there because he's like, this is the only way they're going to get better. I got to show confidence in them. And that's the best thing that in his toolkit that I've seen him do, that, you know, maybe he's among the best at this. And I talked about setting a tone for manager. But he instills confidence, in my opinion, as well as anybody in the game. And that's obviously, is, you know, what the Yogi's saying about how this game is, you know, 90% of the game is half mental or whatever the quote was. I mean, that's so much of it. So, you know, he's a player's manager. He, you know, he's not a media manager. He's a player's manager. And that has really worked, obviously, building the Brewers. And it's obviously worked building the Royals.
Yeah, I don't think you get Eric Hosmer's October or Mike Moustakas' October without that confidence that Yost has displayed in them in the past. And to your point about the media, I mean, I can say from my own experience, you know, Ned Yost is not what you'd consider media savvy in the sense that, you know, when he makes a move that gets questioned after a game, he just does not do a particularly great job of explaining it. Having said that, you know, he does have the motives behind his moves, and sometimes when you get him in a different setting, more of a one-on-one setting, his answers make a lot more sense than they do in a typical press conference setting.
I think I'm sure you noticed in the postseason, and it was one of the storylines, at least from the media side in the postseason, was you know, when you become a major league manager, nothing, unless you were a star player who was really facing the media a lot, and Ned was not, he was a backup catcher. So in that regard, you didn't really have that much media attention. And then you're a minor league manager. You get, you know, very little media attention. Then you're a major league coach. And even the most high-profile major league coaches get, you know, very little media attention, the occasional interview. But it's not that daily grind of, you know, 20 minutes before every game 162 times and 25, 30 minutes after the game 162 times, plus add on the you know, 45 days of spring training. You know, that's hundreds of media sessions in all kinds of circumstances when you're tired and you have to get on the road and travel.
Right.
And all the stuff with that. And so, you know, that I think has been a work in progress for him as he's learned about being a major league manager. I mean, he obviously coached under Bobby Cox, who was always, you know, kind of a great role model in that regard. And he's always sort of been, you know, jealous, for lack of a better term, in how well Bobby was always able to handle everybody all the time and almost to a fault. But that has been his, you know, has been his guiding light, Bobby Cox. And I think what I was going to say was, I think in the postseason, I think Kansas City fans and fans around the country, because you get so much more exposure nationally, of course, in a postseason run like that, I think we were all sort of pleasantly surprised and happy to have him kind of let us all in, for lack of a better term. You know, he seemed to embrace having fun. You know, this might be a once-in-a-lifetime chance. This is something you really got to have fun with. You know, he had been there as a coach many times, but, you know, most of his players and a lot of his staff had not been there. And so he kind of set the tone of, hey, this is fun. Everybody would love to be here right now. Let's not make this some deal where we're worried about every little problem and we worry about mistakes. Let's just go out there, play hard, and have the time of our lives. And they did. And perhaps that has, you know, changed him a little bit in terms of that media persona you're talking about going forward.
Yeah, I'll be curious to see what it's like when you show up at spring training, if that's the Ned Yost we get, or if you reverse course and goes back to quote-unquote crusty old Ned. But, yeah, it was fascinating for me as a guy who, you know, I'm based in the AL Central City. I see the Royals, and, you know, I'm pleased to see you roll through town a few times a year, Steve. And, you know, Ned's a guy that's been hard to get to know in the past. And for me, you know, professionally and personally, it was fascinating to watch that. this new Ned come out last October, and I really enjoyed I spoke with him at length one day in Baltimore during the ALCS about his famous friendships and the impact those have had on his life. Jeff Foxworthy, hunting with Jeff Foxworthy, who in his own way is a great competitor in the comedy world, and then Dale Earnhardt, of course, the late Dale,
right.
Dale Earnhardt was an unbelievable competitor on the racetrack.
Yeah.
And Ned's stories about those guys and the lessons he's learned from those guys were just terrific. There was a story I wrote, a little self-promotion here, but a story I wrote for Sports on Earth at that point where he really goes in depth about those relationships. But there's a very interesting guy beneath the. I think it was actually Foxworthy who said the crusty surface. So
right, right. Well, and we were always amused and somewhat amazed because Foxworthy comes in to visit. You know, Ned's been, you know, by the way, I was going to make another point about Ned. You know, the Royals obviously had a lot of down years in there, but as you know, and those longtime baseball fans know, there was a glorious, glorious time for this franchise, really from its founding into the mid-80s and even beyond. They were a very competitive team in the early 90s. So there was a long run where this team was a successful franchise. And Ned Yost, and we've had Whitey Herzog here and Dick Houser, who's, you know, sadly died of cancer not that long after winning the World Series here. But, you know, Jim Fry, and then later on, you know, Bob Boone and Tony Pena, mm-hmm. and a lot of pretty big name managers have been here. And late last season, just before, I think the last couple of weeks of the season, Ned became the longest tenured manager in Royals history. That tells you something. I mean, part of being a manager is just surviving. I mean, if you keep your job for more than 2 or 3 years, it means you're doing something right, because if they're losing, then they get rid of you. So that in itself tells you something about the success he's had here.
Absolutely. Well, we've spoken at length about Yost, and deservedly so, and this extension is certainly deserved. But one quick thing I did want to hit on, Steve, the Ryan Madsen signing last week, that was, I believe, the Royals' only transaction last week, but an interesting one. A guy who, was one of the better relievers in baseball a few years ago, saved 32 games in 2011. We hear so often, I think at this point we kind of take Tommy John surgery for granted. There's been so many success cases, and we kind of forget about the guys who had it and didn't recover as quickly or had the setbacks. And Madsen's had nothing but setbacks the last couple of years. He's going to give it one last go here with the Royals. Any expectations? Yeah, it's kind of one of those minor league deals where you just kind of hope for the best, right?
Yeah, you take a little gamble, and if it worst case scenario on a minor league deal, if it doesn't work out, I don't know what's in the contract, but it's either nothing or very little that you owe the guy. And they know there is upside there if healthy. I mean, he's had a lot of success in his career, you know, big guy. And what was it? Forget the number, but he had a bunch of saves, 30 something saves 1 year. He's had ability in the past. One thing they've done well here, you know, they're very proud of their medical team and Nick Kenny, their head athletic trainer, and the folks in their medical group, and they, you know, they're very obviously, you know, and of course they had to take this into account signing Kendrys Morales and Alex Rios, and, you know, agreeing to re-sign Luke Hochaver, who's fresh off Tommy John surgery himself, and you know, there's always a gamble there, and you know, how much of a gamble is it is always the question, and you know, we don't know that obviously, but they are very painstaking in their evaluations and doing their homework and talking to people and so forth. And, you know, sometimes you bring these guys in and the guy winds up helping you get to October. And then sometimes they don't even make your opening day squad. And sometimes, you know, they agree to go to the minors for a while. And then as they play themselves back into form a little bit, you have a need, you bring them up, and then they provide a boost for you, whether it's short term or long-term through the whole season. So it's, you know, the way I look at it is, I haven't seen him pitch forever, like most people listening right now, but, or haven't seen, you know, but, you know, why not? You know, if he feels like he can pitch, and they, you know, and there's probably a relationship there. You know, Mike Arbuckle, who's a longtime executive for the Phillies, and he was a big part of their organization as they built up to their world championship and put together that core that now has kind of been broken up or is being broken up because the guys are, you know, beyond their prime in many cases in their franchise in rebuilding mode. But he was there as they were building all that for many years, and so he would obviously have a relationship with Ryan Madsen and know him well, and so that, you know, so they, you know, I just think it's a no lose.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, the Royals have kind of been the reverse of the Tigers in that sense. This offseason, the Tigers, of course, had that awful bullpen last year that really held them back, especially in the postseason. They've done very little to address that, I think. And then the Royals, on the other hand, had this dominant bullpen that they carried them through October, and they've been very proactive about ensuring that remains a strength. So only the season will decide, you know, how the moves and non-moves play out. But that's been one interesting dynamic for me here this hot stove season. But I want to thank Steve Stewart for joining us once again, joined by Jordan Bastian. Talking Tribe here in the aftermath of Ohio State's big victory in the national championship game, and that has some Indians ties. I'm sure Bart Swain, PR man for the Tribe, was quite excited for that. And Nick Swisher, especially, the Buckeyes alum who always incorporates the OHIO into his home run trot. JB, have we heard from Nick Swisher the day after the big game? I know he was tweeting some stuff after the game, but the next day he wasn't arrested for streaking or anything, right?
I haven't heard any updates on Swish. He was pretty quiet. What I thought was funny is he was just totally silent on social media during the game. He waited until it was totally settled before he put his celebratory tweets out there. You know, I can't imagine, you know, when we get around him in spring, you know, how often we're going to have to hear about this, especially me being a Michigan State alum. I know he's probably going to, you know, like to bring that up a couple times. So that's good. Hey, even as a Sparty fan, I can appreciate a solid, you know, incredible storybook season. You know, their third string quarterback has three wins with the Big Ten game, the first playoff, and then the title. It's pretty cool. I mean, that's
cool.
Pretty good for the state of Ohio, which has endured its share of misery along the way.
Amen to that. And, you know, just goes to show what a strong core can do, and that's what the Indians rely on. I don't know if that's much of a transition, but there's a transition for you. Back to Swish now. I mentioned, you know, streaking in the street, and actually I don't think he's physically capable of that at the moment. I know he hasn't gotten into the running program just yet. Sounds like that could happen soon. Probably get reevaluated during the time of Tribe Fest as far as where he's at, you know, physically. But what's the latest on Swish? And I guess outlook, as we're about a month away here from pitchers and catchers reporting.
I think you hit on a lot of the key points right now, which is, I mean, really right now, we don't know so as much as, you know, the Indians have put out, which is, you know, that they're going to have a follow-up exam with him during Tribe Fest, and they can kind of get him in person, you know, and instead of relying on, you know, phone calls and text messages and things like that. So I think it'll be good for reporters to get around him and also good for the team to get around him. And, you know, you can kind of evaluate. He's not going to be running up and down the tunnel for us to see how he's looking, but, you know, I think it'll be a good evaluation for the Indians, and we'll kind of know heading into spring, is he behind, is he ahead? I'm anticipating he'll probably be, you know, on schedule to, you know, be maybe not as, you know, where the rest of his teammates are at the beginning of the camp, maybe slightly behind, but he's got to get to that running program. But he's a guy that, you know, if you remember in the past, he would kind of take it slow into the games anyway. So if he misses the first couple games, once you get to the game slate, I don't think that's going to be a huge deal for him. That's something that he's kind of an approach he's taken in the past, you know, anyway. So, you know, it'll be interesting. I think with him and Moss, the best case scenario, obviously, is that they both open on the roster. But by acquiring Moss, you know, and keeping some of these other guys in the fold, you know, if they do break camp and one of those guys has to stay back and continue his rehab for a little while, if it lingers into the season, you know, they've kind of built in some plans to hopefully, you know, bridge that early April gap.
Yeah, and that's something we touched on in last week's podcast, and then I know Terry Francona elaborated on it in a talk with reporters last week. But, yeah, the Indians have done this before, and they know that you know, you go in, maybe you go into spring training with one plan, you come out with another. The more options you have at your disposal, the better, because teams rarely come out of camp looking exactly the way they might have projected in January.
Yeah, you're right, and it's funny. I mean, we spend so much time in the off season and during spring training, you know, projecting that opening day roster and the who's going to be number one, two, three, four, five in the rotation. You know, what's the lineup going to be? And it's, I mean, really, it's during the course of a season that changes from day to day, especially the lineup. You know, the rotation, once you get past the first five games, you know, you start working in off days and things start getting a little messed up and then injuries happen. You know, we put so much focus on that first 25-man roster that takes the field, but really on day two it can be completely different, you know, and obviously by the end of the year it can be totally different. So, you know, that'll be, you know, I think right now they've put themselves in a good position depth-wise, you know, especially with a lot of the guys they have coming back. It's a quiet offseason really for the Indians, but, you know, a lot of that is because of, you know, the value they placed on their internal pieces over the last few off seasons, you know, locking up so many guys.
Well, one guy they locked up was Jason Kipnis, who was at that national championship game, by the way. Tweeted out a picture of himself with Jim Tressel. And I don't know about you, JB, but I like the tweeting out the picture with Jim Tressel a lot more than the gritty details of food poisoning that preceded those tweets about a week earlier.
Hey, that's what you get with Kip. You know, he's
that's right.
All out there on Twitter.
And he's had quite an off season, not just because of the food poisoning, but also the damaged finger tendon that required surgery, and that of course coming off of a really tough 2014, where the oblique injury that seemed to linger for him and affected him on the field. Terry Francona says he expects this guy to come back with a vengeance. What do you expect from Kipnis in the new year here?
You know, just knowing Kipnis, and I know, I mean, he kind of took some things personally. You know, there were things written, you know, about his physical condition in spring training and last season, and I know that obviously struck a nerve with him. You know, there was the oblique injury that came up, and then, you know, obviously you can look at the statistics, and, you know, we write, you know, what he was doing, and, you know, he wasn't hitting for power. And, you know, I know he's the type of guy where that stuff would get under his skin in the positive way of, you know, he's going to come into camp with a chip on his shoulder, even with this finger injury that happened this offseason. So, you know, I expect him to be extremely motivated. He's a guy that likes to prove people wrong. He's done it in the past in his career, and, you know, I think he's looking to do that this year, and that would be huge for the Indians. They need him. I mean, Francona came out and said that exact line. We need him, you know, and he knows that. And I think really when you looked at the offense down the stretch last year, and kind of as the pitching staff got so strong and the offense was kind of tapering off, you could really see that he was one of those the missing pieces that would have given that offense the type of boost, you know, the Indians could have used when they were trying to chase down the Royals for that wild card spot. So, you know, he's a big part of it. I don't anticipate this finger injury keeping him out of the opening day lineup. You know, they'll obviously be cautious with him in the spring. I think he'll be itching to get going and show everybody that last year was really just a health-hindered season.
You know, if Kip were to suffer any kind of setback, you know, God forbid, in spring training, it seems like Zach Walters is a guy who can, you know, potentially shore things up there in the short term. You think there's, as the roster looks right now, I think there's any role for Walters on the big league club, or is he more of a depth guy at this point? What's the outlook for him going into the year?
Man, I think I wrote it in the last inbox. I think he's one of the most intriguing players as we go into camp because,
yeah,
you know, I think what the Indians see is potentially, you know, not to, you know, heighten the expectations, but almost like a Ben Zobrist type player, you know, where he can bounce around a couple different key spots on the field. You know, he switch hits, and I mean, Francona loves that type of player, and so you could see when they got Walters, they immediately put him in the lineup and said, let's see what we got. And I think they're going to, this spring, probably bounce him around at different positions and, yeah, work him out at second base, you know, in the event that, you know, that's the contingency plan for Kipnis, because, you know, Jose Ramirez is kind of cemented there at shortstop right now. I don't think they want to move him off there, you know, with the strides he made and the plus defense that he presented for that team that needed it down the stretch. So Walters will be really interesting. Right now, I don't really see a fit. If everybody comes back healthy, unless Tito goes with a seven-man bullpen, which is like, you know, that's not something Francona likes to do.
That'd be very un-Tito like. Yeah.
But if he goes with the eight-man pen, I just don't see a spot. If he sticks with a seven-man bullpen, I could see him there as a super utility type guy. The other guy that factors into this too is Ryan Rayburn, you know, who is that versus lefties platoon corner outfield player that's also coming back from knee surgery. He's another guy that they say he's doing great right now in his rehab and he's feeling strong, but that's another guy during spring you're going to have to monitor and see how he's doing, how he's looking. And, you know, maybe if there's a setback there, you also look at, well, that's a spot on the bench that maybe I'll put up with Walters. But if it's going to be a spot on the bench, there's also that argument of maybe Walters can benefit from playing every day and developing, as we saw.
Right.
The power came in bunches, but, you know, the hits didn't necessarily come in bunches.
Yeah. And kind of the underrated change that's going on with the Indians going in this year is the change of bullpen coach. Kevin Cash was so such a valuable member of Francona's staff and just so beloved by these players. They love playing for this guy. He's so prepared and so great to work with. He, of course, gets the managerial opportunity he deserves in Tampa Bay. And the Indians replace him with Jason Beret, who former pitcher for them, of course, but also has remained in the organization in various capacities in recent seasons and especially in spring training, you know, been there as a special assistant over the years. So, What does Francona think about what Beret brings to the table, JB?
He was pretty excited. It reminded me of, you know, when they hired Callaway. Granted, Callaway was a little bit more of an unknown when they hired him. But, you know, the way that they raved about him and just the fact that he has been in the organization for a long time. I didn't realize how long Beret had been in the organization. Sometimes those special assistants, they're not really on your radar. In terms of the staff, I mean, you see them in spring and you see them around the clubhouse every once in a while. I mean, he's been working in the front office side or evaluation side for a decade. You know, so this is a guy who knows
as long as I can remember. Yeah,
right. So he knows these pitchers who have come up in the system, and a lot of them who he's worked with over the years. You know, are reaching the big leagues now, and you know, so I think that helps from a comfort level in a transition period with staff for a player to know that. Okay, we lost Cash. I was really close with Cash. But, hey, it's going to be, you know, Beret, who's been here as well and has worked with me in the past as well. And I think maybe the fact that he was on the evaluation side at the same time, Callaway was working his way up the minor league coaching ranks. You know, that relationship is already established. It's not like you have two coaches going in who have to learn each other's personalities and things like that. I think you're going in already with a duo that, kind of already has that working relationship in place. So I don't think there's going to be much of a transition period. I think the players will be on board, you know, as valuable and fun as Cash was to have around. I think Beret will be, you know, it'll be a pretty seamless transition. What will be interesting is the fact that he has the pitching background and Cash had the catching background. I don't know what type of effect that could have, but Cash definitely brought a little bit different of a perspective to that coaching role. So that'll be interesting too.
Well, we know Jason Beret won't be working with Tyler Cloyd. Tyler gets mentioned on last week's podcast and immediately afterwards gets designated, gets removed from the tribe roster and ends up in Korea. So
yeah,
hopefully nobody else.
Careful who I mention from now on.
I know, yeah. Hopefully nobody else mentioned today ends up going that route, but we'll just have to wait and see. I want to thank Jordan Bastian for joining us, joined by the freshly shaved Scott Merkin. Merk, that was so nice of you to shave for this podcast. You do know this is there's no hidden camera on you here, right?
Yeah, you know, after I shaved, I kind of realized that, but I just feel cleaner and ready to go for the podcast now that I did
you
that.
You feel fresh and clean. You even feel like Thomas Harding.
No one can feel like Thomas Harding. He's unique to himself, but close.
Merk, you have something in common with White Sox. I mean, White Sox fans had to be watching the Royals go to the World Series last year and be like, man, why can't that be us? And you, of course, had to watch Ohio State win the national championship game on Monday night. And as a big Michigan fan, that had to burn you up a little bit as well, didn't it?
It wasn't why can't that be us. It was why can't we win seven games for Michigan, was it? But, hey, you know, I have made no bones as a Michigan graduate that I'm not a big Ohio State fan. But, man, you can't deny that's a coaching job for the ages by Urban Meyer. That was unbelievable to take – a third-string quarterback, who actually was probably as good as most starters in the Big Ten, and you know, pretty easily. I mean, they would have won that by, you know, a massive amount if not for the four turnovers and the one long pass play. But, I mean, just really an impressive job by Urban Meyer. Like, you can't argue facts, and that's the truth right there.
Well, Harbaugh will have his day in the sun.
Oh, yeah.
Michigan, I'm sure.
The final four
and you, and,
year,
you and Rick Hahn can celebrate together. But
I think both will be there next year. It might be Michigan, Ohio State for the championship next year.
There you go. Not hold my breath on that one, Mark. But Rick Hahn, of course, a Michigan grad as well, and he's had quite an active winter. I'm sure Jose Abreu has been very pleased to see that. You talked with Abreu last week, and I remember talking with Abreu at the end of last season, just saying as great as his season was and how happy he was with the transition to the big leagues, he was, you know, disappointed in the team performance, and he didn't feel his individual status meant much given where the team was at. And so, of course, now that the White Sox have significantly beefed up around Abreu and the others, what was his take on things when you talked to him last week?
Well, I think one of the most impressive things about Jose right from the start was that he just got it. You know, he just understood Major League Baseball. And while he was tearing it up individually, you know, he was proud of what he did, obviously. He won, I think, four different Rookie of the Year awards last year, including our own Gibbies. But, you know, he's all about the team success, and it's not just a platitude. He really is about the team success. So he's very excited. He's very excited to have, you know, Adam LaRoche on board, and how that's – he didn't look at it just how it's going to help him and LaRoche in terms of, you know, reducing their wear and tear, but he looked at it as how it's going to help the team overall. And he had a great line, and I can't think of the exact quote now, but it was something about – that, you know, he's not working right now for a 162-game season. He wants the playoffs for the White Sox, and that really seemed to resonate with White Sox fans. And I think, you know, not just that he gets it to the team first, but all his work and the very set pattern, the very, you know, fastidious workout program that he has every day is geared toward making the team better, not towards him getting 50 home runs. If he hits 20 home runs next year and they win 96 games and make the playoffs, I'm sure he'll be a happy individual.
Does Abreu or anybody, for that matter, have a clear grasp on expectation, number of games played at first base versus DH? I mean, I know he's a selfless player, but I'm sure he wants to feel more involved at first base than to be relegated to much DH time at this point in his career.
You know, Rick mentioned this at one of the seven conference calls or either at the winter meetings that he's been on this offseason. He kind of envisioned, at least right now, that Abreu would play around the 109-game mark that he played last year. Now, granted, some of it was injury, some of it was just kind of reduced, you know, soreness by the end of the year. So I would think something like that, you know, LaRoche getting probably, you know, 55 to 65 games at first base. And it'll be a challenge for him, too. I think he has six or seven games started as a designated hitter, so it's going to be interesting to see how he handles his first run as a hitter. But I would think it'll be something, some sort of split along those lines.
Yeah, that was something. I mean, when Adam Dunn came to the White Sox, that was part of his transition, was transitioning to the full-time DH. And some guys really struggle with that. It's such a different mindset, you know, when you're thinking about every at-bat, between at-bats, and that's your only way to contribute to the club. It can eat at some guys' consciousness a little bit during the game. So certainly that'll be something to monitor with Abreu moving forward. You know
it's interesting. I talked to Dunn even last year, and this is his fourth year doing it. And even last year, you know, in May or June, he said he was still kind of tinkering and figuring out the routine. So yeah, it's gonna be a challenge for both guys to kind of get in that set pattern and roll with it.
They signed the other LaRoche, Andy LaRoche. Is this like a package deal? You sign one, you have to sign the other at this point, or what's that all about?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I mean, he's all part of the non-roster invite. It'll be interesting because the Sox, still, as many moves as they've had, and they've seemed to really kind of fill every single spot they needed, and then some, which is another point that Abreu mentioned about how Rick Hahn really just kind of went down the line and knocked everything out. You know, it'll be interesting to see how some of the non-roster invites, someone like a Tony Campana in the outfield. The Sox haven't officially announced these as of yet, but, you know, guys that have kind of filtered out there, how they fit in. They're still, you know, maybe a bullpen spot or the 25th or 24th guy, you know, coming off the last guy on the bench type of thing. Oh, but it could be a valuable spot for the Sox, so... Yeah, it looks like Andy LaRoche is in that non-roster invite mix, and we'll see how, you know, guy who's a good utility player and has even played a little outfield in his career figures into the mix.
I think they just want to help you out, Mark. They wanted that second or third week of spring training when there's, you know, you're kind of out of story ideas already, and, you know, you need something easy. You got the LaRoche brothers feature. That's always a good one, right?
Yeah, God bless the Dank brothers. They went through that for, you know, three three or four years to the point where it was kind of a joke, you know, where you'd walk in and someone would say, Merck, do you know that John Jordan or brothers, you want to do something on them? And which is funny because they ended up started talking about their sister, Emily, who played volleyball at Ohio State and said might have been the best athlete of the whole family. So you do glean a little bit of information. But yeah, this year it could be the LaRoches. And remember, Dave, their dad, worked as a coach for the White Sox for 2 years, which is where Adam kind of got his indoctrination into the White Sox and originally met Robin Ventura as a kid running around the clubhouse.
Yeah. Wow. See, a lot of ties there. All right, so a lot of interest in the Sox. Sox Fest sold out January 23rd to 25th. That's a pretty strong indication of the fan base being supportive of this club. We'll see you know, how that translates in the regular season. But, yeah, have you ever seen interest this – coming off the World Series year, was that the last time you saw interest quite this high?
Yeah, it's coming out of the World Series, obviously, it was packed, and that was kind of almost like a celebration session. People, you know, they have like that. I'm sure a lot of these fan fests have these, but they have kind of a town hall meeting with, you know, Ken Williams as the GM then, and he'd sit and answer questions. And there weren't really many questions. It was more just one by one fans coming up saying, you know, here's where I was when, you know, Palmeiro grounded out for the final out, and you know, my dad told me this story about it and that kind of thing. And there have been some acrimonious ones. I remember, coming off 03 going into 04 when the Sox lost a bunch of free agents and the Cubs had come close, so close to the World Series. It was pretty heated with some of the fans and Ken Williams, and Ken's not one to back down. He's going to voice his opinion, but I think this year is going to be a lot of, is it too late for Rick Hahn to get in the mayoral race for Chicago? He's that popular right now. A lot of buzz in Chicago overall for baseball because the Cubs had a good offseason too, but huge amount of buzz on the south side. I mean, and they're moving to a new location, the Chicago Hilton and Towers. So should be a very interesting weekend. And don't forget that it's also, you know, I think about 9 or 10 guys back in the 10-year anniversary of the 2005 World Series. So the fans are very excited about this nice little winter breakup next weekend in Chicago.
And Rick Hahn's victory lap. And we know how short-lived the dubious title of team that wins the winter can be. But but this team looks solid. It looks very solid. And then we'll see if there are any other moves to be made. Diane Vicieto stands out as a potential trade candidate. They just avoided arbitration with him. But coming off a 21 home run year, which has value in today's marketplace, he could have value to the White Sox as a bench bat against lefties. There's still some uncertainty with Avisiel Garcia on an everyday basis. We have to see, you know, what he can contribute. Contributed a little bit down the stretch, 7 home runs and 190 plate appearances after coming back quicker than expected from the shoulder situation last year. So if they do go into Camp Merck with both of those guys, how do you see this shaking out for Vicieto? What will his role be here?
Well, I think Vicieto, as you said, he reminded me a little bit of kind of a lower example, Alexi Ramirez. We've talked on the podcast before about Alexi having value to the Sox as a starting shortstop and having value as a guy on the market, too. I don't think Vicieto has, clearly, because I think he would have been moved already, doesn't have quite the trade value that Alexi has. But, you know, he's a guy who can come off the bench and pinch hit. He's a guy who could spell some lefties against, you know, left-handed hitters against some tougher lefties. As a right-handed hitter, like you said, you could give Garcia a break every now and then. But the thing is with Diane, you know, great kid. He's worked really hard to try and get himself consistent, just hasn't clicked in there. I don't know if just the power factor is going to be enough to keep him on the bench, although you do have a guy like Bonifacio, who, assuming he is a utility guy, who can play all over for you, and that kind of maybe even takes another spot off the bench because you don't need it with Bonifacio there. But, you know, a lot of times you like that reserve guy to be able to hit, but also be able to play a little defense or run a little bit. And so it'll be interesting to see how Vicieto fits. I really think, honestly, they still will explore trades for him. One, because of the fit, and two, because they're not a team that kind of holds a guy back. And if they feel like there's a better opportunity for him elsewhere, they'll look at that too. But, yeah, I mean, right now I think pretty much any option could be plausible for Vicieto. I would still guess that he gets moved before the start of the season, but, you know, we'll see what happens.
Well, I mean, better to go into camp with that being one of your big questions than to be looking for a cleanup hitter or, you know.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean,
a third starter.
If figuring out Vicieto is the biggest question they have, and they've had a pretty good offseason, which they have, hands down.
And you see that with the Sox Fest build-up, and everybody's excited to attend that, and hopefully to run into Scott Merkin, who maybe – are you going to shave for Sox Fest, too, or do you only shave for
I will, at least that Friday, at least before the first day, I will that Friday.
Okay.
May let it go the next 2 days, but But I think, you know, I'll put on a good appearance that first day for sure.
All right. Well, there you have it, folks. That's a promise. You will see Scott Merkin at his absolute best. I want to thank Merk for joining us. Joined once again by Chris Atterbury of the Twins Radio Network and also of the Twins Caravan. Chris is out there with that group, bouncing around 40 communities in four different states over the course of 2 weeks. It's a major adventure the Twins put on every year. It's a really cool thing, one of those old-school kind of caravans. You don't need who needs a stinking fan fest when the Twins can come to you? They go to the full extent of their territorial area. It's pretty cool. Chris, you're out there with Paul Molitor and the gang. First of all, first impressions of I know as we're talking here, you're in Cedar Falls, Iowa. First impressions of how the caravan's being received and what people are saying about the Twins here this offseason?
Yeah, I think people are pretty excited. You know, we kicked it off yesterday and we kind of stayed in the Twin Cities. And for the 75 years in a row, there's this original St. Paul baseball old-timers group that's been meeting in the back of a bar for 75 years, and they have a big banquet. And St. Paul is the biggest city that's an actual small town in the world. And these guys go back hundreds of years together playing ball. And they put 500 people in the room, and when they saw one of their own and Paul Molitor up at the head table and Joe Mauer was with us and Kirk Bean from just next door in Stillwater, they were very excited. It's almost as if, you know, that it's a piece of each one of them is going to be managing the Twins. And it's been really neat. And, you know, Paul's such an interesting guy. His resume speaks for himself, but he's such an interesting guy to listen to answer questions. Because, you know, you're getting a lot of random questions from kids asking him what his favorite book is or if he has a pet, you know, to people asking about prospects or people asking about, you know, other teams in the division. And he's a really thoughtful guy, a real smart guy, and that really comes out in these face-to-face sessions. And I think the whole theme, if you were going to encapsulate it, is we're done worrying about the past and talking about the past, and we're really excited about controlling what we can control today and looking ahead to try to do that every day over 162.
So does he have a pet or not? That's what we need to know.
You know, he did not have a pet. Glenn Perkins, won the day with the elementary crowd because of his new Labradoodle, Harry Potter.
Oh, okay. That'll get you in good graces with little kids, that's for sure.
I can also report that Paul did not necessarily have a favorite character from Frozen, but that Glenn Perkins went with Olaf.
Ah, that's also a good choice, see? And I'm sure many of those communities you're visiting are frozen as well. I saw Molitor actually said, the way the Timberwolves and Wild, the way things are going for them, the Twins are a particularly great source of optimism right now. But, and you mentioned he's a thoughtful guy. I know he's kind of a forward-thinking guy when it comes to the way the game is played these days with infield shifts. I know he was a big part of that last season, implementing those and using those. What are your thoughts, Chris, on what Paul Molitor brings to the table as a manager here?
Well, I think he brings a couple things. One is he is a forward-thinking guy, and he's not going to be boxed into any one particular way of doing things. He's never going to be a guy who says, no, that's how it's always been done. If you look even at his playing career, he played for a lot of different types of guys in a lot of different styles. And so I think that's big. I think he has instant credibility with players young and old alike, based on just what he did as a player. I don't think there's any way you can look at that as a young player and not stop and listen. And he's a guy who is confident enough in himself and who he is and what he thinks to take input from any of a wide variety of people and not be threatened by it. And I think that's a critical skill in the modern game for a manager. A lot of people will tell you that it's become a general manager's league and you've got, managers who are beholden to what the front office wants them to do. And if you look at the great managers in the game, and I think that, Bruce Bochy's one of those guys, Terry Francona is one of those guys, Joe Maddon's one of those guys. They're all guys who are able to listen and to take input and mix and match it with their own ideas and not to ever be threatened by that input and then to go out and put that into practice while maintaining credibility with their players. And people like to make an old school, new school divide, which I think is a lot of that is creation. But if you look at the great managers today, they're kind of a combination of that old school in the clubhouse baseball man and the new school idea of bringing some new thoughts into that room. And I think Paul can do that.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think, you know, teams at this stage, they don't want a dictatorial presence in the manager's seat, but they also don't want a puppet either. They want a guy they can collaborate with. And it certainly seems that the Twins, Terry Ryan, has that with Paul Molitor. I look at this as a big year for Terry Ryan. You know, he's put a stamp on this team again at this point, coming back into the general manager's role, and he's made the change at manager. He's gone out there again and invested heavily in free agency. And you know, again, we kind of touched on this last week, Chris, but just your overall sense of how Terry Ryan has handled things this winter, knowing the Twins again had some needs in the rotation, especially.
Yeah, you know, I think all of us who are around Terry on a regular basis, the beauty of Terry Ryan, and you know, I'm out here with Glenn Perkins, and Perkins is a guy who was drafted by Terry. He's known Terry since he was a little kid, and can speak to it from a player's perspective. There's just a universal respect for Terry, because Terry will tell you, I disagree, I agree, I think you're right, I think you're wrong, here's what I'm doing, here's what we did well, here's what we didn't do well. And you always know exactly where you stand with him. And I think that's all you want in any line of work. And so Terry knows there's work to be done, but I also believe that Terry feels very strongly about the idea that if you continue to grind away at something the right way, it works. It pays dividends, and he's seen it work before. And he also puts a lot of trust in people that he hires and that he brings on board to do their jobs. And, you know, take Ricky Nolasco. They gave him a bunch of money, and Ricky didn't do his job very well. And I think Ricky would tell you that. And Terry certainly has told Ricky and other people that. And, you know, best laid plans can go awry if guys don't actually perform. So I like what he's done, and I think Terry's a guy who is so respected here that, you know, if Terry, you know, went out and made a bunch of crazy moves, I think people would, even if they recognize how crazy they were, I think they'd almost be like, well, he must know something we don't know. And I think that he has that type of respect, and I think he's really earned that type of respect. And, you know, even to the point where you hear people, and we hear it all the time out on the road, say, well, you know, that they trace back a lot of the problems the Twins have had in the last 4 years to the time Terry was away from the club. And that's not entirely fair, and it's certainly not entirely true, and Terry certainly hasn't been perfect. Nobody really has, but that's almost the feeling you get when you talk to fans.
Yeah, he's a rare bird, and I think, as far as I know, he's the only general manager who will he'll meet with the media every day if you want to talk to Terry Ryan. He'll meet with you in the lunchroom before the game, every single game during the regular season, which is a rare thing, and there's just a level of accountability there that you don't always get from that position. So that's certainly, you know.
And not even just the accountability. I think there's a level of transparency. Now, Terry's never super forthright. He's not going to be a guy to trumpet how they're doing business or what they're looking for specifically. They're not going to send out press releases about how smart they are with their analytics. And he's not going to blow his own horn, ever. He's not going to tell you who he wants to trade for, but he's certainly going to fully engage in a conversation about what happened after the trade commences. And I think writers certainly respect that, and I know the players respect that. You know, like a small thing, even when all the rumors are out there, and in this day and age, you know, with Twitter, it happens instantly, right? An agent or another player or a family friend spills it out about a trade. Terry will not talk about it or confirm it until the player has passed his physical. And the reason he does that is because, God forbid, it gets out there and they say, yeah, we've made the seal, we haven't made the seal. And then something goes weird in the physical, you know, that 1 in 100 chance, and it doesn't go through. He never wants to put a player in a situation where now they have to answer questions about that, or where they're embarrassed, or where they feel like, you know, they were misled. And I think players respect that, the way he treats them with that level of respect for them as individuals.
Well, one last thing, Chris, here, and it kind of fits with the physical conversation there. You mentioned you're with Glenn Perkins on this trip. Of course, the way his season ended with the strained right forearm, some nerve irritation. How's he feeling now? He's such a big part of this club. You know, we talk so much about starting pitching upgrades or what that area is going to look like, but you know, the Twins have been fairly steady in the bullpen, and Perkins is obviously a big part of that. So how's he doing?
He's doing great. Yeah, he's full bore. There's no problems. I think when you say strained forearm, which was true, but it was for the third straight year, it was more like strained bullpen, right? Because they just weren't getting the innings from their starters. And
right.
Hopefully, Irvin Santana will take a long step in shoring that up. You know, Jared Burton has been let go, and and is off looking for something else. And so there is a question of who's maybe going to be that setup guy in front of him. Casey Steen's done a great job in that role. Tim Stauffer's a guy that they've brought in with the chance to work for, in a variety of roles in that pen. But, you know, with Neil Allen coming on board, again, there's a fresh set of eyes and a fresh way of doing things and a very energetic way of doing things. And, you know, and we'll see how that all winds up. But I think the guy at the back end, there's certainly no questions there.
All right, Chris. Well, thanks again for joining us, and enjoy yourself out there on the caravan. Again, it's taking place over the next couple of weeks. So if you're listening to this, maybe the Twins are coming to your community. But thank you all for
if your
in.
Community is cold, we're probably coming.
Are you coming to Cleveland then? Because I, we can use a little brightening our day too. So thanks again, Chris. All right. Thanks everybody for listening. This has been MLB.com Extras, American League Central Edition.